Blog Talk Radio.
Movie Geeks United this Wednesday evening. This is our We're Gonna Try It Again show.
It's the hump day, take two, part two, everything you want to know.
Yeah. Sunday night we had, we were anticipating to play the entire interview with the writer-director of Hump Day and the actors, Mark Duplass and Joshua Leonard. And we had problems with our system that the interview wouldn't upload. But I've been assured that the interview is now uploaded, and we can play it in its entirety tonight.
Awesome.
And then discuss a little movie news a little bit later. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing good. You know, I mean, it's another Wednesday night, keeping our fingers crossed, hoping for the best. You know, it's the middle of the summer. Not the dog days of August just yet, but it feels that way. And
Did you see Harry Potter today?
I saw Harry Potter last night. I'm working on about 2 hours of sleep in 48 hours, so...
Okay.
We'll talk all about it because I actually have a lot to say about it. And
we'll get to your review then. But let's get to this interview.
Mm-hmm.
This is writer director Lynn Shelton and actors Mark Duplass and Joshua Leonard from the new hit film Hump Day, which is now playing in Seattle and New York and opens this weekend in L.A. It's a great, funny, really energetic new independent film that everyone out there is raving about, and if you haven't heard about it, or certainly if you haven't seen it, go check it out. Here is Lynn, Mark, and Joshua talking about their new film, Hump Day.
Yo,
yeah.
I'm Ben.
I'm Andrew.
We're old friends from college. We've kind of gone down different roads. Ben is Mr. Motorcycle Adventuring Man.
I've been living in San Cristobal de las Casas down in Chiapas, Alabama.
Where? I have a really nice house and wife and stuff. We were out at a party and we heard about Hump Fest.
This awesome amateur porn festival.
You have to do something unique.
These great dudes.
Beyond gay.
It's beyond gay. And the funny thing was, we were drunk when we first came up with the idea, and then it evolved into this weird straight guy macho thing.
This shouldn't be about us challenging each other.
Give me the pill!
It's all on.
Is somebody having sex in his film?
Yes, as far as I understand.
What are you doing?
You said you were gonna tell her and she said she knew, and then I just talked about it and I guess she didn't know.
I cannot believe I'm talking to you about making a porn film with him.
You're pretty solidly not gay.
Yeah, I think the same thing about you, too.
We might have to impose the pretty woman rule.
No kissing.
This is weird.
You're not as Kerouac as you think you are, even though you've got the headband on. I love you. And I am not as white picket fence as you think I am.
There's a six-pack under there.
Nothing that I want to do less than what we're talking about doing. Ready?
Ready?
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Yeah, that was awful.
Dude, that was awful. It's gonna be hard.
Yeah, that puts a little wrench in the works, doesn't it?
Where did the idea of this story originate from?
It started with Mark Duplass. I wanted to work with Mark, who I'd met on the set of another film called True Adolescence. So I was trying to think about different scenarios, different characters that might be fun for him to play around with, and Another buddy of mine, Joe Swanberg, another filmmaker, came to stay with me in Seattle and went to Hump, which is the real name of Hump Fest, and in Seattle, that is a real festival, amateur porn festival. And he talks about the gay porn that he saw at this festival, and he talked about it quite a bit for the next several days. And I found that really amusing, and I was wondering why I found that so amusing, that a straight guy would talk, you know, a lot unselfconsciously about the fact that he was compelled by this gay porn that he'd seen. And I realized it was because there's a very specific relationship that straight guys have or are supposed to have with gayness, and just because of the fact that he had gone to this festival and gay porn was kind of, I don't know, it just started my brain going around in very devilish circles, and I came up with a bar and entertaining scenario.
And I'm assuming that, you know, when you came up with this idea, that obviously you must have known that, okay, this is provocative and this is going to raise eyebrows, but how do I get past the provocativeness and actually get people hooked into the story? And how early on did you realize, you know what, I can't just simply do a, you know, the hook of the film. I got to get involved with it emotionally.
Yeah, right away. I mean, I think from the very beginning realized that this was going to be a movie that had a high concept that was going to get people into the theaters. But it would really be kind of a MacGuffin, you know. It would be this this way to get people in there, and then once they were there, I was going to kind of pull the rug out from underneath their expectations by giving them a really believable and human treatment of what they, you know, what sounds like it's just going to be a broad farce. But none of us were interested in making this movie at all, unless it was going to be, you know, trying to meet the challenge of doing it in a believable way.
What do you contribute that is in the air, in the zeitgeist in the last couple of years of, like, with the Apatow films and, you know, I Love You Man, with kind of this notion of, you know, mandates or bromance, that in Hump Day is not that, but it kind of sort of subverts some of those conventions from kind of the mainstream films that are dealing with similar issues.
Basically, why is bromance in the air in general? These kind of, there is a long history of buddy movies. I mean, I just rewatched Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and that is classic man love. You know, man on man, right. Straight guy and straight guy, platonic but very very passionate man love, and so it's been around a long time. But you're right, there's more that's sort of coming up to the surface. And I mean, I know that my film, I don't think Hump Day could have been made, you know, 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, at least in quite the same way. Or maybe it wouldn't have had, we could have made it, but it wouldn't have had the same kind of accessibility. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that people are just more open about and cool with gayness. You know, homophobia is frowned upon these days, you know, thank God. And it's just one of those major cultural shifts, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really fascinating to me that it happens to be opening in New York and Seattle on the same day that Bruno is opening, you know. And there's another movie that is obviously a totally different tone, but is really kind of dealing with a lot of the same territory, you know.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's just kind of a big sort of cultural moment, I guess.
And you studied theater, and I'm wondering what that background, how that background served you with this particular material, because obviously, you know, this could have, you know, this is kind of a idea that could be one of those experimental theater projects, but obviously you're working in film, so I'm wondering what of your theater background did you bring to this material?
I think an empathy for the acting process. I know that I also remembered that when directors really trusted me as an actor, that I always brought more to the project, you know, more of myself, more energy, and I think I did a better job. And so, and that sense in general in theater, that was the one time in my life that I really had experienced collaboration. And so, you know, I wasn't the one at the helm, but I'd been a part of that process. And so that, I think, all contributed heavily, that background, that ease with the collaborative process and also the empathy with the acting part of it is why theater influenced this way that I'm working now.
This was really good, by the way.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad you dug it.
I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. But yeah, just back to the Andrew thing. I mean, he's just lost, you know? And even last night, you know, I just was watching him at that party, and he's just, like, trying to get something going in his life, you know? And the good news is actually he met some people there last night, you know, kind of just his kind of peeps, and they're all involved in this sort of art festival, and they've invited Andrew to be a part of it and sort of add his own piece to the festival. So
That's
he's
great.
Totally psyched, and he's like, "Oh man, I need your help," and you know, so I'm like, "Sure, of course, I'll help out." Like,
so
not
cool.
that I know, you know,
no, that'll be great,
or whatever,
though.
But
That's
you know,
so great. Is it a festival that they put on themselves?
It's this cool thing, actually, that The Stranger does. It's like this film festival that they put on every year. I hadn't heard of it. And they make these kind of artsy films. What's that?
It's not Hump Fest, is it?
I'm not exactly sure. That might...
The porn festival? The Stranger does a porn festival every year.
Well, I didn't know necessarily what it was because I hadn't heard of it, but their take on it was it's an art festival that is about reclaiming pornography back to an art place instead of like a disgusting place that we all know it as, was my understanding of the project.
Is somebody having sex in his film?
Yes, as far as I understand.
And what are you doing with the...
I just told him I would help, you know, so I'm just going to like, you know... You know, lackey stuff is what I'm assuming. You know, I don't know what the job roles or titles are would be, but I'm assuming I would, like, maybe I can, like, make them breakfast or something, you know, like, feed the crew, because I know it's, like, a low-budget kind of thing, or I could, you know, bring coffee in, or, you know, if they needed, like, copies or something, I could just run to Kinko's and make some copies, or... I mean, I don't know. I think I'm not an artist, and, you know, that's not my thing, and so I just want to lend my support, because he's super excited, and they're going to do it tomorrow night. And I figured, you know what, I should lend a hand on that. So, you know, I thought that was pretty cool. I thought it was... You know what, we don't even have to... We can talk about this later. Let's just enjoy our dinner, okay? I love you.
Mark, I'll start with you because Lynn said she wanted to. She originally wanted to work with you, and so when she came up with this idea, what was that like when she said, "You know, I have an idea that's something I think we can work on," and she tells you? Did she tell you the idea, or did she just give you the script and say, "Look at this"? And what was your reaction?
She pitched the basic idea of two guys who are interested in hump fests, and they're straight guys, and they're interested in potentially making a porn film for hump fests, and that was it, you know. There was no script, there was really no set story at the point she brought it to me. And we kicked it around a little bit and got to the idea that the two straight guys would actually try to make one of those films for the festival. And then, you know, she asked me if I wanted to play Andrew, the character that Josh plays, and I felt a little more connected to Ben. And I had just played a role in a movie called True Adolescence where I was a bit of the Peter Pan slacker, kind of a little bit too old for the adventuring lifestyle, and so I didn't want to repeat that role. And so, then the question came up of who's going to play Andrew? And I immediately thought of Josh because we had struck up a friendship recently, and I knew he had the right energy to work at least opposite me, you know, and at the risk of sounding pretentious, or actually there's really no risk, it's going to sound pretentious. Lynn and I both felt like I have such a strong, dominant personality, and I argue very forcefully, and I argue with, you know, every ounce of intelligence that I can muster, and I usually dominate most people. And we needed someone who would be sort of, you know, a really true equal on this front. And I knew Josh well enough to know, like, he's super smart, he's very sensitive, very aggressive, can also be very passive aggressive and manipulative, all the right qualities for, you know, a true adversary.
Sounds like y'all had a connection early on, even before the material. But Jack, let me ask you.
It's wonderful to know that somebody thinks so many wonderful and terrible things about you all at once.
Really?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, what was it like when you heard about the concept and you read it? What was your initial reaction?
Well, I just have to say, I got the most obtuse film pitch in film history, which was Mark Duplass, I believe, in retrospect, playing on the fact that I was a fan of him as a person and as a filmmaker, who just sent me a one-line email asking me if I wanted to play his best friend in a movie that his friend Lynn was directing. To which I said yes, to which he then told me it was a film about two straight guys who try to make a gay porn. So I walked into this project doing it for the people, much more so than for the pitch. And I guess had enough faith in Mark, and then because of his vouch for Lynn and subsequently watching her films, that nobody was interested, as Lynn said, in making a farce.
Yeah.
And so that became really interesting. It became a tremendous challenge to take such a kind of stupid, high-concept pitch about these two doofusy alpha male dudes who paint themselves into a corner and reverse engineer into something really human and really,
right,
hopefully relatable.
Well, let me ask you this, Josh. I mean, this film was a big hit at Sundance, and obviously, you've had the Sundance experience with the big sensation. You know, it was literally, I guess it was 10 years ago, returning to the scene of the crime with the Blair Witch Project. What did you know now, when going to Sundance, of that experience, that, you know, you were in a film that was going to be buzzed about, as opposed to from that first time around?
Well, I think right now, I think just personally in my life, I try to work with people I like. I try to do things that I think I'm good at and, you know, do my best once I get there. And then if things do work out, just to appreciate every second of it, because in my experience, most of the time, it doesn't work out the way you think.
Mm-hmm.
And I know just the stamina and the absolute lack of backup plan are the two things that have, you know, kept me going for the last 15 years in independent film.
Mm-hmm.
But when, you know, there's no better case scenario than when you make a film for the right reasons with people that you love and respect, and an audience responds to it too. It is such an absolute win all the way around that, you know, and with the limited amount of theatrical distribution at this point, just knowing that Hump Day is going into theaters with, you know, about the budget of an economy car, you know, is really the amount of obstacles that you have to swerve around to even get where we're at is such a win that, you know, I'm just really grateful for it. And don't expect the next one or the next five to work out so well, but, you know, it's a great checkpoint along the way.
Right. When did y'all realize, you know, obviously y'all knew each other, so there must have been a little bit of an inherent trust there, but then when you started really working, you know, working with the material and kind of feeling it out, when did you realize, you know, okay, yes, we knew each other before this, but, you know, now that there really is an emotional connection going on between you two in the acting, how early on did that occur, or was there a specific moment when that you realized that was occurring?
had a very strong instinct about Josh, and I you know, you meet enough people in this world where you get a great feeling right off the bat, and I had a very good feeling about him. But I would say it was in that process of Josh, Lynn, and myself hanging out in L.A. in the back room of my house, talking about the story, developing characters, and I can't pinpoint a specific moment, but, you know, it was that process of the three of us pitching ideas to each other, and normally when you're in that scenario, people justifying and fighting to the death as to why their idea was the best.
Mm-hmm.
But Josh and I very quickly realizing that, like, we had no ego involved and no reason not to just take the best idea in whatever came. And he and I were both equally good at that. And so it was then we started having those sort of knowing looks with each other that, you know, really, really builds that nice connection.
Right. And what's the reaction like been from audiences? And I guess particularly, what have you heard from the men in the audience? What do they say when they see this film?
Gay dudes love this movie, and I don't exactly know why, but they're loving the movie. You know, the straight guys that I have talked to specifically in this movie, you know, the thing that's really connecting with me is they're saying things to me like, man, I kind of didn't want to come see this movie because the premise seemed a little stupid, but my friend told me I should, so I did, and I'm so glad I did because I never really thought I could connect with the thought of having sex with one of my best friends. But knowing what this movie is rooted in now and knowing that it's about friendship and it's about the desire to connect with your former self and the best version of yourself and how confusing that gets, you know, I really see, like, holy shit, like, I could see myself doing what Ben and Andrew got themselves into, and that's a huge victory for us.
Yeah, what a quote to end the interview on.
Yeah, that was classic.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, that movie's Hump Day. It opens this weekend in L.A. and in other cities wider as the weeks go by. Jerry, if you could look up a website and post it in the chat room. If you're able to do that,
yeah.
That'd be great.
For
Hump Day.
Yeah, sure thing.
It might be humpday.com, I'm not sure. In the meantime, Chris, how you doing, man?
Yeah, I'd be real careful what Hump Day sites you link to in the chat room there.
Yeah, dude. I mean, the thing I found, though, don't worry. It's not anything that it just... it ain't bad. Don't worry.
All right. It's the movie site. Okay.
Okay.
So what's going on, man?
Oh, not a lot going on here. I was just chilling out with a glass of tequila, watching The Talented Mr. Ripley.
That's
tequila.
A good movie. Underrated movie.
Just happened to be on TV. You know, it is an underrated movie. And every time I watch it, I get sucked completely into it. When it came out, I know this is not Hot Topics here, but this is, you know, like cutting radio here. We're talking about a movie that's over 10 years old, I'm sure. But
that's a good movie to talk about. So
no, it really is, and all the performances are top notch, and it's so beautifully shot. And Anthony Minghella, I'm just nuts about everything he ever did. So
yeah,
it's one of those movies that sucks me in a way not like the same way that Casino does if it's
mm-hmm.
on TV. You know, we've talked about before. Every time I pass by Talented Mr. Ripley, I can't not watch it. I get sucked into it every time.
That's a great underrated Matt Damon too. That's that's a tough part.
Yeah, it's a beautiful soundtrack. I love the soundtrack to that film.
Yeah.
Speaking of Matt Damon, have you discussed on this show The Informant, or I should say The Informant?
Yeah. No, we haven't, and I'm glad you brought that up because that looks really good. That was my favorite part of Public Enemies.
Yeah, me too.
The trailer for that's the new Steven Soderbergh, right? It's comical.
Yeah.
Matt Damon plays the worst CIA informant in history or something.
Yes, yes. Have you seen the preview for it?
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah. I wasn't expecting, maybe I was confused, but when this project's been gestating for a long time now, and I guess I didn't know that it was supposed to be a comedy.
I had no idea. I was shocked. To be honest with you.
Yeah, I was too. I'm very pleased about that, though, because, you know, we've talked about it before. I like to see directors stretch out and do different things, and he's no stranger to comedy. He's done comedies before, but, you know, you hear Steven Soderbergh's doing a movie about a CIA informant, and you just kind of
mm-hmm.
have in your mind that it's going to be this dark, brooding piece and whatnot, and then all of a sudden this trailer comes out and looks like something completely different. So.
Yeah, and it's based on a Kirk Eichenwald nonfiction book, and, you know, he's a serious journalist, so I never put it together that this was supposed to be funny. I was like, whoa, quite different.
Yeah. And an interesting supporting cast, too. Scott Bakula and Joel McHale from The Soup, who is hysterical, so...
Yeah, it's kind of like the new Coen Brothers movie. The biggest star in the new Coen Brothers movie is Alan Arkin, or Adam Arkin, actually.
Yeah. Cool.
But in terms of the Soderbergh thing, he just did an interview today where he talked about how he thinks he only has a couple more years left as a filmmaker. I think he's really down because of the situation with his next planned film, Moneyball, fell through for him.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. He alluded to that in on Elvis Mitchell's show too. He didn't say it quite that specifically that he only had a couple more movies in him, but he basically said, I think I have only got, you know, 7 or 10 years more of filmmaking left in me, which is unfortunate. And you got to think that not only Moneyball, but also the reaction to Shay had a lot of several films.
Yeah,
and well, just, you know, some of his smaller projects, like The Girlfriend Experience, whether it was good or not, it's difficult to get the kind of, you know, he can get a lot of people to come sit through an Oceans movie, but he has trouble getting people to go see, lately anyway, some of his other, you know, more thoughtful, you know, and thought-provoking, intellectual-type movies.
Yeah.
Well, some of those movies, like The Girlfriend Experience and Che, like, I watched those on demand, and I'm wondering what the reaction has been, or what how well those have done on demand.
Shay didn't gross a lot of money. I mean, I think it made back cost, actually, which is a triumph with that kind
of
project.
For that movie, that is a triumph.
And the thing about it is, I mean, yeah, he struggles, but he gets the stuff made. So he never struck me as someone that was only making movies for them to be popular. He struck me as the kind of director that was in the game to see how much he could do. And how different his career could be.
That's true, very true. But him in particular, we talk a lot about how the movies of the 70s were thought-provoking, but also were very popular. And actually, his career in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, he was kind of walking both ropes there with movies like Traffic and Aaron Brockovich and Out of Sight. He was sort of having his cake and eating it, too. He was making these popular movies that people were going to see, but also they had a little bit of something to say, you know, and they were also very well made. And he seems to not be hitting that note so much the last couple pictures. And I agree, I don't think he's the kind of guy who makes things just so that people will go see them, but it's got to hurt when you make two or three in a row.
I think this Moneyball thing is the thing that stings the deepest.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how successful he thought a movie like Shay would be. But with Moneyball, it's a big project, studio project with Brad Pitt. They pulled the plug based on Soderbergh's version of the script that they say makes no sense. And then they don't drop the project completely. They just take Soderbergh out of the equation.
Why not have Michael Lewis bring in Sorkin to
do a draft of the script? But Brad Pitt's still attached.
I would let Michael Lewis, actually, who wrote the book, and I would let him come and give it a shot. I wouldn't drop Soderbergh out because it seems like something. Moneyball is popular enough, but not. I mean, it was a bestseller. It's Michael Lewis who wrote Liar's Poker and wrote a lot of stuff about Silicon Valley in the 90s. Is popular enough that Soderbergh is like really the right director for it. The only other director you really want to get, the only other director I could really think of, is David Fincher.
They didn't agree with his vision, and that's their right, I guess, as the people financing the movie. And just because you're the author of the book doesn't mean you know anything about screenwriting.
No, but I would give him a shot. I would give it a shot. I mean, like Michael Lewis, I mean, give him a shot.
I think Aaron Sorkin's going to be fine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just saying. I mean, I would bring in Lewis, though, because he's actually pretty talented, and I'm sure... just as a consultant or something. He's a good writer.
Apparently Soderbergh, it's his way of working, too, where he kind of discovers the movie as he's shooting it, and they're not comfortable spending $50 million on that kind of experiment.
That's a lot of money in this day and age.
But he's also got lined up, I know, two interesting projects, doesn't he? I think he's got the he's got like a Cleopatra musical or something like that, I seem to recall, which I don't know how interested I am in that, other than the fact that it's Steven Soderbergh, but also this Liberace piece that he is supposedly working on with Michael Douglas set to play Liberace, and then Matt Damon set to play, I think the guy's name was Scott Thornton, I believe, something like that. Liberace.
His lover.
His
lover.
There you go. There you
go. Who, Liberace actually had this guy go through plastic surgery to look like him, basically so he could bang himself. And Liberace was such a weird guy and such an interesting guy anyway. So.
I mean,
wouldn't that be a great project for Soderbergh, though?
That would be a big project.
That would be a good project for Michael Douglas, too.
Yeah.
My father met Liberace, spent an afternoon by the pool with him in Vegas one day. Yeah.
Really? That's interesting.
He won't go into any more detail than that.
Doesn't bother to really talk about it after that.
Said
as
he was very...
As long as he didn't spend the afternoon in the cabana with Liberace.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't the cabana boy, was he?
No.
Okay, thank God for that. All
right. Okay, well, that's Soderbergh. The big news this week for movies has to be Harry Potter. It had the biggest midnight screening ever. It beat The Dark Knight by about $4 million. Last night, it made over $22 million. So this is going to be a huge movie. Now, the record for five-day opening is The Dark Knight still.
And then Transformers 2.
Yeah.
Let it be Transformers 2. If not Dark Knight, let it be Transformers 2. Because I don't read the Harry Potter novels, but I've said before on this show, and I do believe that these movies are getting much, much better as they go along. And I haven't seen this new one. I'm probably going to see it tomorrow or the next day. But they have been getting much, much better.
They are getting better, yeah.
And also, just like with the books, it's kind of like we're sort of... barreling towards the end here, and it's sort of an avalanche type feeling that you get with these movies, that as we get closer and closer to the end of the books and the movie, I mean, obviously we're at the end of the books, everybody knows how the story ends who has read the books, but in terms of people that don't read the books, this is sort of, we're winding down here, and it seems like they're going to get bigger and bigger. Obviously the last book is going to be two movies, because it was so big.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't be surprised if this turned out to be, you know, the biggest grossing movie of the year, actually, because just based on the midnight numbers, and I know lots of kids go see the midnight showing for Harry Potter, and lots of people, but these Harry Potter movies have a tendency to sort of have legs to them, and they make a hell of a lot of money.
Yeah. This is the most interesting one in terms, because I watching the movie last night, I think I know why they delayed it. These guys were scared shitless of Twilight.
Is it that, or is it that they wanted... See, what I had heard was that they sort of wanted to space out their money and get some money from this and not have all their money in 2008 because they made so much money on Dark Knight.
Part of it, but if you're watching it, the first half of the movie, Chris, is like the raging hormones and everything, and you're like looking at it and you're like, my God, these guys were really kind of spooked by Twilight. There's actually a big article in the Washington Post about it today, but not enough that it hurts the film, I think, but it's definitely something the producers were aware of, and it's there. I mean, it's obvious.
But they weren't trying to copy Twilight, were they?
They're trying to... See, this is the thing. When the last Harry Potter book came out, there was a big worry in the publishing industry. What are we going to do? You know, what's next? All of a sudden, there's this Stephanie Meyer, her Twilight books fill this void. And, you know, then the idea of making movies, and the movies are enormous. I thought last night there would be a trailer for the new Twilight movie on this. There wasn't. I was shocked because it's the exact same audience, but it's also, I realized, the competition now. They were kind of definitely trying to get the girls from Twilight, who are obviously going to see this too. I didn't see why you needed to do that, because it's the same audience, pretty much. But it's there. You can definitely see Twilight's the elephant in the room. I don't know if it's the best Harry Potter, but like Chris says, they do get better. They do. It's one of those. It's a weird series where usually series like the decrease in quality, these get better in quality. Although I still got to say the third one is my favorite.
I like the Alfonso Cuarón one a lot too. But these romantic elements that everybody seems to be talking about in reviews and things like this one's got a lot. They're making those, you know, connections between this and Twilight. It's not like the makers of this newest Harry Potter movie put these elements in where
they were there in the book.
I
mean,
yeah, it's there
in the book. I just think, I mean, it's not a bad thing. It's definitely one of those Twilight sort of came out. I didn't know about Twilight until a year ago, the books at least. I had no idea, and then someone told me about it, and I read articles about it, and people were camping out for the newest book, so it was becoming like filling the void that Harry Potter left. But it's an interesting movie. Like you said, you want it to definitely beat Transformers 2. It's interesting. I just don't know where it ranks with the other ones. Like, I really like the third one, and the fifth one a lot.
Yeah.
And I think the thing here is that I noticed a lot of the complaints about this film are it feels like the middle. There's no beginning or end because you're just waiting. This is almost like a waiting game. There's not a lot can happen in this one because you're waiting for the big thing that happens in the next one, which is actually going to be two films. So they're really stretching this out.
So now what's happening? How many more are left?
There's two more movies. They split the last book into two films because it's so big.
I wonder if they'll release those like 3 months apart from each other. Like
2 years
Back to the Future
now.
Thing.
2 years. I think one's next summer and then the following summer. I think I'm not positive on that. They're really stretching this out.
Yeah, I don't. I would be surprised if they did, like Jamie's saying, release one next summer and then possibly release one, you know, in Christmas or something like that. I don't know that that's already set up.
That's a smarter move, I think. I think stretching it out like this is almost nerve-wracking for the really diehard fans.
Well, I mean, they've tried it both ways in recent years. Like, they've done the yearly release, like with the Lord of the Rings movies, and previously with the Harry Potter movies, they pretty much wait a year in between.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one comes like a year and a half since the last one, or possibly more.
Yeah.
But, the only other movie I can think of that did the 3 month or 6 month type thing was the Matrix movies, wasn't it?
The third
Matrix movie released about 6 months after the second Matrix movie. And that's hard to make that comparison because those movies weren't based on books that were already popular, so the script wasn't there. But,
the third one imploded, really. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was, you know, evident at the end of the second movie.
Yeah, the second one, when no one stayed. To watch the trailer for Revolutions, everyone left. I thought that said something.
Yeah, I actually enjoyed the third movie more than the second.
I would agree with that. I think the third movie's better, but likewise, for whatever that's worth. I mean, it was so draining to sit through the second one that you didn't. The third one was better, but, you know, it's like, all right, the second one was an F, this one's like a D-. Okay.
Yeah, that's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, so predictions for the Harry Potter gross for a 5-day weekend.
Oh, God. You love doing this. You really love doing this.
Well, what is the record? What is the
All right, so I'm going to go with 185.
Holy shit. What's the Dark Knight number?
Isn't it like 20? What is it?
I think it's 205.
205. All right, 185 is what I'm going with.
I'll lowball it. I'll go 175.
Oh, you're always lowballing. I'll go 200.
That's a fair. I think you got it. Because there is nothing else this week. I mean, Harry Potter is all to itself.
Yes. Yes.
And next week too, for that matter. I don't know if Orphan or I take that back. G-Force. God forbid, G-Force could be formidable competition. This year is going.
That's true. This thing has some weeks to itself, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But this Harry Potter movie does sort of strangely here in mid-August or early August, or excuse me, July. We do have some other summer movies, but we're pretty much coasting downhill on the summer movies here. We've seen all the big ones. We've seen all the huge ones. G.I. Joe is yet to come out, but
I think that's the next big one, I think.
You think so? I think
we're going on what, you know, if I, you know, the Transformers, that kind of Generation X nostalgia thing. I think we're going on that, but I also think, you know, the kids get excited for the trailer and everything, and so I think you're going on that. I think Funny People comes out a couple weeks before. I think that has there's huge potential for that, and but we are coasting down. You're absolutely right.
I'm not so sure Funny People. First of all, I think Funny People, while it is released in the summer, it's not necessarily a summer movie. That movie could come out anytime.
Mm-hmm.
It would probably do about the same amount of business anywhere. I don't know that there's a place you could put that movie where it would be advantageous.
I never saw Bedtime Stories. Will I be able to follow it? I never saw Bedtime Stories. I didn't even realize it was an Adam Sandler movie, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't. I'll be perfectly honest. I'm not nuts about Adam Sandler movies. When he gets with a good director, though,
yeah.
he has a tendency to make a pretty good movie. You know, Punch Drunk Love or Spanglish.
Or Rain Over Me, I thought was good. I mean.
For me is another one, but, you know, I don't know that movie's going to do the kind of business. You know, look at Bruno. I personally thought Bruno would do a little bit better than it did. $30 million for a movie that I probably won't have legs. $30 million,
it's going to have anything, yeah.
No, and that movie, I don't know how much Bruno cost to make, but it can't have been $30 million. So they're going to make some money on it, but it's certainly not Borat money, you know.
No.
No,
and so it'll be a disappointment to them. I mean, he's going out and doing advertising now, promotions for it now after it's released,
mm-hmm.
because he knows that they're in trouble with it falling off. Meanwhile, people are protesting the thing left and right. The Ukraine won't play it. Barbara Walters started talking about how it's the most pornographic, non-pornographic movie she's ever seen. And this is Barbara Walters. She's been around.
Wait, she doesn't go on the internet?
Well, apparently not. But I saw her clip of her talking about it.
I know,
it on the
I saw
internet.
That too, but I just want to say, honey, you don't go on the internet? I mean, come on.
Well, Barbara Walters has been around.
I know.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, she banged Richard Pryor, for God's sake.
Dude, that's what I love about Chris, man. He just comes out straight, all guns blazing, yes.
Do you have footage like that? You'd think she'd have a taste for the profane.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, Bruno's going to fall off fast.
Have you guys seen Bruno yet?
I haven't, no.
Okay.
I want to.
Okay.
It's the kind of movie that you got to have a crowd. You got to have a crowd to go see it. Frankly, I don't know if there's going to be a crowd when you go see it
right.
this weekend. Or,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'm not sure how well it's going to work.
Okay.
Okay. You know how we love the lists.
Oh, God, what list do you have now?
This is a really kind of stupid list.
What, did you steal one of mine?
No.
Okay.
I'm looking at Entertainment Weekly as usual.
Yeah, you said it. You said it. Stupid, okay.
The 13 must-see on-screen heists.
Okay.
That's when you know you're out of list, isn't it? When
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay, just go down the list.
Okay, Ocean's 11 is number 13.
Which one?
Ocean's 11, I guess it's the closing heist.
No, but I mean, which the remake or the original?
Oh, no, the remake.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
No, I like the Ocean's 11, the remake and the original, but I just was just curious. I guess no one, all right, many people don't even know it's a remake. Okay, forget it, sorry.
A Fish Called Wanda, number 12. Was that a horror?
No, I mean, I don't. Yeah. That wasn't the thing that really stood out in the movie for. Okay,
No, it's true. Jerry's right. Like, there's no real heist there. I mean, yeah, there's a scene where they bust into the place, but there's no real lapse during the scene. You don't really get an idea of what's going on. They just steal some diamonds. All right, whatever.
Wow, Entertainment Weekly gave that movie a C.
That's bizarre, because that movie holds up like
mm-hmm.
a son of a bitch.
Yeah.
It's really, really funny still, and I've seen that movie easily 15 or 20 times
yeah.
in my life, you know, and I can watch it today and still laugh out loud.
Okay,
yeah.
You go down this list, because I have a feeling some important heist films are not on this list, so...
Out of curiosity, what did they give Ocean's 11 in terms of a grade?
An A.
Yes.
Okay, all right.
How to Steal a Million with Audrey Hepburn and Peter O'Toole.
Okay, that I could see on there, all right.
Number 10 is Inside Man.
Okay.
Inside Man was the original title for Hump Day, by the way.
Dude, man, he's on a roll tonight, man.
God bless you. I'm like sitting here, I'm sipping hot green tea. So my voice is going through a trauma and turmoil since I quit smoking. The Italian Job, the original.
That should be on there.
Yeah. That's number 9. And that's the pause in between is my computer loading the next page.
Oh, okay, that's cool. I understand, dude. I got you.
Feel free to make conversation about The Italian Job.
Okay.
That's actually a good remake, too.
I love the end of that movie. I just think I love, it's a great Michael Caine movie. Ralph Fiennes in it, and Noel Coward. I love that movie. Benny Hill's in it.
Hill's in it, really?
Benny Hill is in it. Yes.
Number 8 is the remake of the Thomas Crown Affair.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. It's a great movie.
Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah,
yeah,
I love that.
I can see that. Hey, I can't argue with that.
There's already a heist that I know is not on this list, and I'll wait till you finish the list, and then
I know which one it is too.
On a jag about how this movie is awesome and no one ever talks about it. But go ahead, please.
I think it's clear what the number 1 should be, but hang on.
All right, well, let's see.
Number 7 is The Lavender Hill Mob.
That's a classic film.
Alec Guinness.
Mm-hmm.
He's stealing.
I'm surprised it's on there.
Stealing gold from the place where he's worked faithfully for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. It's a great film. Very funny.
Mm-hmm.
God, you guys, really, yeah. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for honing in on my endorsement there.
Number 6.
Sorry, I got to be honest. I've never seen it.
Okay, that's cool. No, that's cool. That's cool.
Number 6 is The Usual Suspects.
Okay.
Oh, yes.
Okay,
yes.
Thank
Excellent.
God that's on there. Okay.
And actually, there's a couple of good heists in that movie, so,
yeah.
You know.
Okay.
Another one that holds up very, very well.
Oh, yeah.
The music in that movie is incredible, by
it's
the way.
It's phenomenal.
Oh, my God. Mm.
Keep filling.
Yeah.
Mm.
You know, but, oh, wait, we're waiting for that to load. I have
It's like my favorite part of Edward Scissorhands. It reminds me, with Alan Arkin, just,
yeah.
Oh, that's great, Eddie. Ooh, that's wonderful. number 5, I guess we're on now. The Asphalt Jungle.
Yeah, I'm just surprised they go that far back. That's a great film. I actually saw that in Los Angeles at a revival house. That's a wonderful film. I'm just surprised it's on there. I didn't think they went that far back.
There's only so
many heist movies that you can go for, you know.
Oh, I can think of a lot they probably don't have on here, but okay.
Yeah. We're not done yet.
I know we're not done.
Number 4. Jerry, as usual, waiting for the load. Number 4. Nine Queens.
Yeah, that should definitely be on there.
Nine
Lord, Queens. Jerry. You see a hell of a lot of movies.
I do. You never saw Nine Queens. They remade it as Criminal. Remember that movie Criminal?
Oh, yeah, John C.
Criminal. I was not even aware that was a remake.
Yeah. Scene for scene remake, almost.
Really? Oh, I like Criminal a lot, so I'll go ahead and find out my Nine Queens.
Yeah,
number 3 is Heat.
Fair enough.
Well, without a doubt. Seems a little high. What?
Seems a little high. In terms of numerically, seems like Heat would be number 1 or number 2.
Oh,
like,
okay.
As you get down this list here, I'm thinking, well, what are the 2 that we're missing, you know?
Right. Okay. They gave Heat a B-, by the way, in Entertainment Weekly.
What a bunch of cocksuckers.
Number 2. So Ocean's 11 was a better movie than Heat.
Yeah. Nice. Nice job, Entertainment Weekly.
Thank you, Entertainment Weekly.
Number 2 is The Killing.
Okay, that I...
Of course.
Stanley Kubrick's, and this only leaves one option for number one. I don't see how it could be anything else. Hang on, it's loading. If I had a drum roll, I'd play it.
Yeah, I thought you did have a drum roll.
I did it one time, yeah. But
what about
course,
the theme from Oscar, Oscar? Can you play that?
Yeah. Okay, here it comes. No, this is a bullshit list. Their number one. Their number one is. It's a great movie. It's Reservoir Dogs.
But did you never see the heist?
Right. My number one would be Rififi. Right? Am I right?
I would. I was thinking about that, but I was thinking of something else actually.
What?
What were you thinking of, Jerry?
Sexy Beast.
Oh, another great one. That was not what I was thinking of. But oh, you're fucking right.
Yeah, man.
Oh.
Isn't that just the craziest heist?
That's one of the greatest heists ever put on film.
Yeah.
That's better than what I was thinking of. Oh, yes, that's definitely my number one, absolutely. However, I will say that David Mamet's Heist has an incredible heist.
Oh, yeah, that's a great film.
It's a great film that no one ever talks about. Yeah. And every time I've ever shown that to anyone, whether it was a girlfriend or a friend, it's always met with a, pretty good. But... like where I'm expecting, you know, them to go, holy shit, what an amazing movie, and what incredible writing, and what incredible directing,
yeah.
what great performances, but no one ever talks about it. It's unfortunate.
Yeah, and why wouldn't Rififi be there? I mean, that should be
on there without a doubt.
That movie's known for that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the most, you know, they want to remake that thing forever.
There are a couple of French gangster films, a lot of Melville films, actually, that I could put on there. The other one I was thinking of, you know, even though it's obvious, I would have put The Bank Job somewhere on there.
Right.
I would have. I mean, I don't, not so high up, but I do like that film a lot. But see, the problem with Reservoir Dogs is it's one of my favorite films, but you never see the heist. I'm under the impression this list was you see the heist.
Yeah, I got to agree. In fact, you don't even know much about the heist in terms of how it played out in Reservoir Dogs.
Right.
Again, I agree. Great movie. Everything about it is stellar, but there's no heist in it, unfortunately. I mean, there is a heist, but you don't see it.
Mm-hmm.
So how the hell does that make this list?
This is obviously the lazy days of summer at Entertainment Weekly. We just let the interns do it.
All right, Chris, here you go. I wanted to give you a chance to respond to this Woody Allen list.
Yes.
The 40 in order. Okay, top 10 are number 10, Purple Rose of Cairo, Sleeper, Zelig, What's Up, Tiger Lily, Match Point. Yeah, what the hell is that there for?
Why is that on there?
Match Point, Everything You Always Wanted About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask, Hannah and Her Sisters, Bananas, Annie Hall, and Manhattan at number 1.
I've got to also take umbrage with Everything You Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to Ask. That movie gets a pass because, you know, I think mostly because of the title and because it was based on a book that was very popular.
Mm-hmm.
But quite frankly, as a big Woody Allen fan, that movie's not incredibly funny.
Yeah.
It's got a couple of parts that are funny. You know, obviously the Gene Wilder bit is very, very funny. And I'm a fan of the part where, I don't remember the titles of the sequences, but the part where Woody Allen is the jester, that one's pretty funny.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the last one with the human body and Burt Reynolds, you know, roll out the tongue and all that stuff, that's funny. That movie is not great, and it's unfortunate that immediately I think of other Woody Allen movies that belong in that top 10 that are far better. Certainly better than that. Where's Stardust Memories? Where's Sweet and Lowdown, you know?
Stardust Memories is number 14. Sweet and Lowdown is number 18.
That's
bizarre. Yeah, Bullets
very,
Over Broadway,
bizarre.
17. Deconstructing Harry, 16. Small Time Crooks, 15. Husbands and Wives, 21. Vicky Cristina, 24.
That's just...
Well, it's a testament to Woody Allen that he has this many movies that can make us groan because they did not make the top 10.
Yeah.
You know.
Crimes and Misdemeanors, 11. Here's the bottom five. which I went over the other day. No, here's the bottom 10. Here you go. Manhattan Murder Mystery, number 30, which I enjoy.
I enjoy that too.
Yeah.
Scoop, number 30. And if you remember, Manhattan Murder Mystery was made in the thick right when this scandal started. I mean, he used Diane Keaton as a replacement for Mia Farrow, and he was shooting it as the scandal was going on. And it's one of the fluffiest, like, lightest movies that he's ever made.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Scoop at number 31, Alice at number 32, The Curse of the Jade Scorpion, my personal least favorite, at number 33.
That should be there, yeah.
34 is Another Woman, which I think needs to be in the top 10. Melinda and Melinda, number 35. Shadows and Fog, number 36. Hollywood Ending, 37. Celebrity, 38. Anything Else, 39. And September, number 40.
Huh. That's strange. September? It was not a bad movie, really.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen it in a long time, but I don't remember it being, it should be much higher than that.
Certainly better than Curse of the Jade Scorpion or anything else or Celebrity, you know. It is true that when Woody Allen makes a bad movie, it seems worse than it actually is. If somebody else had made Anything Else, you wouldn't think much of it, you know. If somebody else had made Curse of the Jade Scorpion, it would just be forgettable, or Hollywood Ending. But with him, you know, it's just so shocking. Like, this mind put this out and thought this was on par with things like Broadway Danny Rose and Purple Rose of Cairo.
Where
and
is Broadway Danny Rose on that list?
Oh, I don't know. It's gone now.
Okay. All right. No, don't stress your computer out anymore.
Apparently, it's in the 20s somewhere.
Okay. Well, really? That's a funny movie, man.
That is a funny movie. Yeah. And they also have a list of the 25 greatest active film directors, and Woody Allen is nowhere in here. even though he's the most active film director there is, really, because he makes one at most two a year, with regularity. Who is on here is Favreau at 25. A very weird list. Almodovar at 24.
I could see that. I mean,
Greengrass at 23. P.T. Anderson at 22. Ang Lee at 21.
What is the criteria exactly?
Ron Howard at 20. There's no criteria. There's just the greatest artistic. I think it's artistic. Okay, 19. Clint Eastwood.
Okay. Well,
Danny Boyle.
Okay.
Danny Boyle, 18. Aronofsky, 17. Zack Snyder, 16.
Wait. Okay, I think Zack Snyder, I don't know, I don't think he's a visionary. I think he's very good at recreating someone else's work. If, you know, when you used to play with your toys and recreate your favorite scenes from the movies, that's essentially what he's done. He's recreated a comic book frame for frame.
Right. Well, or even with Dawn of the Dead, he had... I like Dawn of the Dead, his remake, very,
so
very
do
much.
I.
But he had a pretty clear... You know, it's a parallel example with 300 and Watchmen. He had a pretty clear-cut piece to work off of there.
He had a story. It was all storyboarded out for him. I mean...
Yeah.
Hmm,
that's
number 15 is Sam Raimi. Number 14 is Judd Apatow, who's made three films.
What the?
Yeah. Well, you could say the same about Zack Snyder.
I don't think Snyder belongs on the list either.
Well, and frankly, I got to be honest, I don't think Paul Greengrass belongs on the list, or certainly not higher than someone like Woody Allen, who's not even on the list, you know? Like,
right.
Did you say most active? Is that the thing?
25 greatest active film directors.
Wow. Where's Terrence Malick on this list?
Well, keep reading it.
Nowhere to be found. Tim Burton, number 13. David Fincher, number 12. Guillermo del Toro, number 11. Joel and Ethan Coen, 10. James Cameron, 9. Michael Mann, 8. 7 is Quentin Tarantino. Ridley Scott is 6. Steven Soderbergh, 5. Christopher Nolan, 4. Martin Scorsese, 3. Peter Jackson, 2. and Steven Spielberg won.
Wow, this is a strange list. I, you know, I can't really argue with anyone that's on the list. I like all these filmmakers.
Yeah.
But the numbering is bizarre. And, yeah. You know, and it is a little bit subjective. It's your own personal opinion, although
right.
I think everyone would have, you know, that top 10 would be probably everybody's same list, but in maybe different order. But when you start talking about guys like Jon Favreau and Zack Snyder in place of Woody Allen and Terrence Malick.
And Spike Lee.
Spike Lee. Why isn't Spike Lee? Talk about someone who's active. I mean.
Yeah.
Why not Kevin Smith then? I mean.
Little subjective, kind of hard to quantify the best. I mean, everybody would say, anybody would put Steven Spielberg at number one.
Yeah,
right.
I think that's a safe bet.
Would you put Scorsese above Peter Jackson?
Yes, I would put Scorsese and Spielberg. You could put either one of them in one or two, and I would not argue with you because that's, you know.
But active filmmaker. And the reason I said Terrence Malick is because if you have Zack Snyder and Greengrass, you know, Terrence Malick's at least made four films, five, if you count Tree of Life. I mean, he should be on there given the criteria they're using. I mean, but is it active? I mean, you know, where is Spike Lee? Where is, you know, someone
yeah.
that makes all these movies? Where's De Palma? I mean, then maybe, you know, why isn't he on there for that matter? They're all very active. They're all making films.
Well, I like the idea that I like that they have. What was I going to say? Wes Anderson's not on there.
Mm-hmm.
But I like that they have Chris Nolan so high up, and he's only
yeah.
made a few movies. But
right. It's a strange list, very strange.
Yeah.
All of these lists are. But speaking of Twilight, did you hear that they postponed the Avatar show for Comic-Con so that it wouldn't interfere with the Twilight show?
Yeah, I was reading something about that. What were they afraid of?
Well, they're afraid that everyone will be in the Twilight show and they won't have enough time to make it to the Avatar. And they're both the events of the year
yeah.
for that trade show. So,
yeah. Wow.
So, whatever that's worth, I guess.
You almost feel like New Moon doesn't need that kind of press, you know?
It's
like,
built
yeah.
in. I mean, you could open that tomorrow and it would wipe everything out.
Yeah, I mean, Twilight, if you think when the Twilight movie came out, there really wasn't a hell of a marketing blitz for that movie. There really wasn't. There were previews and everything, but it wasn't all over the place. It wasn't, you know, they weren't, like, shoving it down your throat the way they do with some movies.
Yeah.
I don't think that they need this huge, and frankly, the Twilight movie did well, but it didn't do that well. I mean, it wasn't.
Yeah, I noticed that too, Chris. It wasn't like they weren't breaking down the door like a week or so later. I mean, it was all that weekend, really, and over Thanksgiving. Then after that, it dwindled.
Yeah, and on top of that, on top of what it did in terms of business, it didn't get great reviews. From anyone. I mean, I understand this movie's made for teenage girls, but it really, the Harry Potter movies are made for British teenage boys, and those movies get very good reviews.
Right.
It didn't do terribly well among critics. So.
Yeah, critically, it was lambasted. I mean,
I feel like people are giving this movie a little bit too much of a wide berth where it doesn't really deserve it, you know, necessarily.
Yeah, like I said, like it feels like it came out of nowhere. But you don't need to advertise. You really don't. I mean, you like I said, you could open this up Friday, and everyone who wants to see that will be there.
Yeah. They'll go see it. Whereas Avatar, I can understand. Even though it is James Cameron, even though among the industry there's a lot of anticipation for it, in terms of the public, you do need to sort of build a little bit more momentum for something like Avatar. You need to get people aware of it.
Yeah,
And I don't think that that's true for the Twilight or the New Moon movie.
You know, Cameron is the tenth director, the tenth highest grossing director. He's all the way at number 10.
Wow!
Most profitable movie director. He is in 10th place. Total domestic box office of $1.147 billion. That's in the U.S. I mean, that's not overseas. Ahead of him, Sam Raimi's movies have made more money.
The Spider-Man movies, I think.
Yeah,
that's heavily weighted because of Spider-Man movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
1.24 billion. Tim Burton, $1.26 billion.
That's probably the first two Batman movies.
Peter Jackson, it's about $1 million more than Tim Burton. Gore Verbinski is even more than Peter Jackson.
But that's because of that Mouse Hunt movie,
yes.
Right?
Exactly. That's the Mexican. That's what that's all about. That's classic, Jerry. So Gore Verbinski is the number five most profitable film director. Number four is Chris Columbus.
Ooh,
because of the Harry Potter.
And I love you, Beth Cooper, in that.
And Mrs. That, Doubtfire. Ron Howard with $1.6 billion.
Oh, I'd definitely see that, yeah.
All that Da Vinci Code stuff. George Lucas is third.
Really? You mean after all that merchandising and everything?
Well, in terms of domestic box office, yeah.
Well, yeah. Now, let me ask you this. Is that strictly the films he directed now? Because you also got to remember The Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, he didn't direct.
The movies that he directed.
Okay.
But
wow.
Even the last, even if you count the big four that he directed, that's enough to get him in.
Yeah, that's enough to make sure your future generations don't have to worry about college tuition.
As a result, since he's only directed a few movies, his per-film average is $340 million, which is far and above anybody on the top 10 list.
Yeah.
Number two, who would number two be?
Spielberg, yeah.
It's not Spielberg. Spielberg is number one.
Oh God, and who? Who would
number
be
number two? Let's see.
Not Coppola.
It would
no.
be one of the Pixar guys, possibly. John Lasseter,
like a Brad Bird or something. Yeah, but it's not. It's Robert Zemeckis at number two.
Oh yeah, yeah. No, that yeah, the Back to the Future. Yeah, man, all that stuff. I mean,
who also was not on that list of the top 25 greatest?
Yeah,
characters.
Where was he? I mean,
although I want to say something about James Cameron, and we've touched on this before, but you know, all those other guys on this list, again. Great directors, and this is not a list that you can argue with because it's based on numbers, but it should be mentioned that all those other guys have one or two or three movies that were bombs, you know, guys like Sam Raimi and even Steven Spielberg has made movies like Amistad and things like that, didn't make a lot of money. James Cameron has yet to make a movie that was not popular. He has yet to make a bomb, if you don't count Piranha 2, for which he was fired from.
The Spawning.
The Spawning.
Yeah.
Dun, dun, dun.
That's a little strange.
Yeah, that's a good career. Okay.
Yeah, it is.
Well, anything else, guys, before we meet up again on Sunday night?
I have a question for both of you. And, I mean, obviously, how is Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, do you think it's going to be a big hit? Or do you think it's going to be one like more like on line with maybe Grindhouse, somewhere in between Grindhouse and Kill Bill?
I think it'll do well. I think that a summer release will benefit that movie. It'll probably, I would guess that it will end up raking in somewhere in the 100 million range. It's, you know, maybe even less, maybe 90 million or something like
that. Okay.
I don't think it's going to be a huge blockbuster, but I do think it's going to do good numbers for him. I mean,
okay.
I think people are going to go see it. It'll get not only the people that are interested in seeing a Tarantino movie, all the Tarantino
but a war film, an action film,
yeah,
too.
Some of those war and action film kind of fans still want to go see it too.
I'm just curious because like I'm like going back to a generational thing. Like Tarantino's really like a iconic figure of Generation X more than anything else, maybe Generation Y. But just like judging from what I've seen, the reaction to movies that I've seen. Lately with the masses, like Transformers 2 and the Harry Potter film, and you're listening to the kids and everything, I'm like wondering, are they going to really be into, does the Inglourious Basterds seem like almost like to them an old fogies movie almost?
Well, it's rated R, or it's going to be. I don't know if it's actually rated R yet,
no,
but it certainly will
be.
And so that's going to keep a lot of those people out. You know, R-rated movie has a ceiling on it in terms of how much money it's going to make. It just does. So, I don't think it's capable of making the, you know, obviously it's not going to make Transformers.
No.
I don't even think it's capable of doing something like The Hangover, which is an R-rated movie. I don't think it's capable of those kind of numbers because you're not going to get that Hangover is rated R, yes, but adults will go see it because it had that word of mouth built around it and everybody,
right.
And people are still going to see it because it's a guaranteed good time, you know, it's
right.
Just a bunch of laughs, whereas Inglourious Basterds, again, I haven't seen it, but it's a little bit more of, it's not just laugh riots and dick and fart jokes, you know, like, you got to kind of be willing to sit through a story
and
follow these characters through.
And it is a talkie from everything we've heard. From when we had Eric Kahn on from IndieWire, I mean, he did say, you know, there's a lot of talk in it.
Yeah.
And that was one of the criticisms, ironically, you know.
Yeah, it's very ironic, I think, and unfortunate that the guy who we first put on a pedestal because of his great dialogue,
mm-hmm.
now we're shitting on him because he's making a movie with a bunch of dialogue.
Yeah.
I think it'll top out at about $60 million.
That's what I'm thinking, 60 or 70.
Yeah.
Like, the same as Kill, like, both, when Kill Bill's domestic, both of them was around, what, 70, 80 million?
Yeah. It is curious, though, because we tend to still think of ourselves as a certain age group.
Mm-hmm.
But that was 16, 17 years ago when he hit. And he hit people of that age group that are now those age kids. What are they interested in now? I mean, what are the young 20-somethings interested in now from their cinema?
Well, it was promising. I was talking to someone in line last night, a guy, I think I'm going to say like a freshman in college, and he really liked The Hurt Locker a lot. So I thought that was promising.
What do you see that they're interested in, Chris?
Well, I think it's fucking Transformers, unfortunately. I think it's shit like that. No,
yeah.
I mean, obviously, that's what it is. It's Transformers. It's possibly this G.I. Joe movie. Harry Potter, you know, there's just not a lot. Well, that was, if you're talking about Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, that was at a time when, you had, the summer movie thing was definitely happening, but there was also, it was the blossoming independent film scene, so there was a lot of interest in littler movies, and a littler movie had a better chance of breaking through, whereas now we see, in terms of little independent movies, we only see one or two that break through. In the early 90s, you would see several more than that. You know, you'd see around 10 movies each year that sort of came out of nowhere, Crying Games and Pulp Fictions and things like that, that would sort of come out of nowhere, and all of a sudden built this buzz around them that everybody wanted to see them. You just, I think that the market has just ballooned so much that those movies don't have a chance anymore. So there's no chance for a culture of those kind of movies anymore either. Because where are you going to find out about them? You're just not, like for us, for instance, here in Florida, in Lakeland anyway, we can't see The Hurt Locker right now. We can't see Moon right now. We can't see Away We Go right now. We're not going to be able to see 500 Days of Summer in a week or so, whenever that comes out.
Right.
We can't see them because they're just sort of choked out by Transformers. And, you know, some better movies, they're choked out by some movies like Up and The Hangover. Those are big-budget movies that are choking out these littler movies, but they're choking them out nonetheless. It's big-budget studio pictures that are just, they're choking everything out, and you can't get in there. So how's the culture going to develop?
That's true. You know, I was just, you know, and even if you have a landmark, like we have the landmark, which is one in D.C. and the one close to us in the suburbs here in Bethesda. But look, if a movie doesn't do, even an independent film, doesn't do well that first week, they drop it. It doesn't even last that. I mean, maybe a week if you're lucky. But sometimes, or look, there's something like Southland Tales. It's got a very limited release. That didn't even last a week. That lasted 5 days. That was booted the Wednesday right before Thanksgiving. It opened that Friday before, and then it was booted out that Wednesday for all the movies like The Mist and Hitman and August Rush. You know, all those films were coming out. So Southland Tales got the boot.
Yeah, well, count yourself lucky that you even get 5 days with a movie like that. And I have no love for Southland Tales. But, you know, Southland Tales didn't play at a theater within, you know, 200 miles of us down here.
I believe it
just doesn't, we just don't even get to see those movies. It's not possible.
Yeah,
so
no,
frankly,
I understand that.
All this stuff about, you know, like movie piracy and stuff like that, I don't condone it. But in a way, I kind of understand how people want to go download a movie like The Hurt Locker or something like that, you know, because how the fuck else are you going to see it if you live, you know, in Lakeland, Florida, or, you know, Topeka, Kansas, or,
right,
you know, something like that? Where are you going to see that at? You just
Sean Levy actually wrote an interesting article the other week, and he's, of course, in Oregon.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he's in
Portland. And he just, out of the blue, he looked in the paper and discovered that Tetro had been playing in his town for the past 5 days, and he's the critic for the largest paper there, and he wasn't even told. That they dropped the ball in the marketing for that area. And when you're releasing a little film like that in cities, one city at a time, it's essential to get the press on your side because they can spread the word about it.
That's just insane that you would not do that for that movie. That's just ridiculous.
So it is tough. And then you have people like Crispin Glover that's been traveling colleges for years with his movie. Some movies are like that, though. I mean, some movies are such a specialty and a novelty that might be your best means of making income off of it is traveling with it.
Yeah, the festival circuit, you know, doing it that way, and like you said, going to, like, what he's doing with the colleges and everything, that's the best almost direct distribution, if you will.
Because there ain't a chance in hell that,
that
movie's going to succeed in the multiplex.
No. But they have that in the multiplex. Give the people the choice of that.
Well, but they did. See, that's the thing. When the independent movies blew up in the early 90s, throughout the 90s, you started to see the studios pick up the littler movies and start to try to play them. But the problem was the audiences can't differentiate, and how can they, really, between what is a good independent movie and what's a bad independent movie. If the studio is going to pick it up, they're going to put it out in the theaters, and it's going to have a little bit of a marketing blitz, but it's not going to have a Transformers marketing blitz. So basically, they're just going to pick it out and put it out there.
Mm-hmm.
So then the audiences go and they say, well, maybe I'll go see Waking Ned Divine or something like that the studio has picked up and put out there. And it sucks. It's frankly not a very good movie. So then studios don't want to take those kind of risks anymore and pick up those little movies and put them out because they tried it for a while and it was hit and miss. It's too hit and miss. That the independent movies, it blew up and the bubble burst and all these independent movies were all over the place and you don't know what's good and what's not, unfortunately.
Right.
So now we're back to the point where you're seeing your independent movies, but they're just not getting picked up at all anymore.
Well, this is what I think the on-demand thing comes in, really. If your cable provider has it, although our cable Comcast has dropped the Magnolia Pictures on demand thing. So
really?
Well, yeah, they dropped that. We have IFC on demand, but they dropped the Magnolia Pictures is no longer on it. So I don't know what happened with that.
Well, what do we think of what do we think of the prospects for Wall Street 2? Tim mentioned it in the chat room.
Oliver Stone was talking about it on Bill Maher.
Yeah, I saw that.
And, you know, I like the idea. Like, when I hear him talk about it, I like the idea, but I don't know that the movie has any chance of being terribly, terribly good. Frankly, because Oliver Stone, as much as I like Oliver Stone and I like to champion Oliver Stone, Oliver Stone's not making a lot of great movies anymore. Oliver Stone has not been making good movies, not to put too fine a point on it. He hasn't made a great movie since Nixon, in my opinion, and that was 15 years ago.
That's really the last solid good. Although I think W, the more I think about W, the more I like it, but it's not in the same league as his earlier stuff. I mean,
right, it doesn't belong in the same conversation with things like Salvador.
Right,
and JFK and Natural Born Killers, it doesn't belong in that conversation. I mean, I like W in its own way, too.
Yeah.
But I sort of feel like this is, I think he's making it for half the right reasons and half the wrong reasons, unfortunately. I think that he wouldn't make a movie unless he thought it was a good idea, but I can't help but think he's sort of thinking, maybe this is got a chance that I'm sort of touching on something I did in the past, plus I'm bringing in this young Shia LaBeouf, and it's touching on this new thing, so maybe it's going to be popular. I do think he wants to make a good movie every time out, but like I said, that's not happening.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, I think he's made the greatest, one of the top three greatest American movies of all time with JFK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, so I do think it's in him to be one of our great film directors. But you're right, he hasn't delivered in a long time. And this is his first sequel.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the currency that Wall Street has. I mean, beyond, you know, aficionados of the art form.
Right.
You know? But yeah. I think they would sell it on the performance, on the return of Michael Douglas to the performance that won him the Oscar.
I think that's what he's banking on, really.
Yeah, even much more so than the relevancy of the movie's theme,
mm-hmm,
or subject matter.
Yeah, and
probably,
who knows? You know, and that's so fluid. No pun intended. That's so fluid. Who knows? Where this is February 10th, I think, or something. It's the release date or something next year. They're thinking,
yeah,
February. You know, it doesn't matter about that. But I think you bring Gordon Gekko is definitely one of the more interesting characters, and it'd be just curious. I think people would be curious who watch, you know, like the original one. Be curious to see where this character is at now in this time,
mm-hmm,
after all this stuff has collapsed, the financial system and everything. It's an interesting premise, but, you know, we'll have to see.
But here's the thing, though. What audience is there for a sequel to Wall Street other than the three of us? We all like, or anyway, I like, and I assume you two both like Wall Street.
Yeah.
And we're sitting here discussing the idea of a possible Wall Street sequel, and all three of us who liked the first one seem a little lukewarm on the idea of a third one. So what possible chance does a movie like this have of gaining new audience,
mm-hmm,
you know, if it can't even win us over with the idea, really, you know, 100%.
Right.
What possible chance does it have of winning over everybody else? I don't think very much.
It's a problem when you wait this long, but when you revisit a movie this long after, I mean, whether it's The Godfather or The Two Jakes, I mean, it's hard to recapture that magic.
Yeah.
That you had.
Yeah,
it's very hard, and I would imagine, regardless of whatever the current situation is, regardless of that, Oliver Stone, like you said, he's not making the movies he once did. This is an uphill battle for him, I think.
I don't hear his voice anymore,
mm-hmm,
in his movies. And I think this goes back to conversations we've had about people that the giants in their careers, and then they make a series of bad choices, or we don't connect to them in the same way as the years go by. They're different people. They have different motivations, different perspectives. You know, they don't have so much to prove. With Oliver Stone, you have that white hot. You can feel his temper and his outrage and screaming to be heard in those great earlier movies.
Right.
What does he have to prove anymore? I don't see what he wants to share anymore. I don't see any urgency in his films anymore.
Well,
yeah, I believe that he still has something that he wants to share. I believe that he still has that vision. I just feel like he's not been able to get it across. Like, even with Alexander and World Trade Center and W, I feel like it was there in the inception of the project, but for some reason, you're right, Jamie, it's not burning,
mm-hmm,
through the screen the way it did in those earlier movies. I don't know why,
mm-hmm,
that is.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, are we all convening again Sunday night? I don't think we have any guests Sunday night.
We'll find something to talk
right
about.
It's kind of laissez-faire movie geeks, but
yeah,
I like
laissez-faire a la carte.
A la carte. I like the three of us together.
Yeah, no, it's good.
We make a good threesome. Okay, guys, so Sunday night,
be here.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
Good night, everyone.
Good night, guys.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night. Bye-bye.